Hi, welcome to the Audio Engineering Podcast with me. Oh, that's far too radio.
That was well Coogan-y.
Shall I go full Coogan?
Yeah, good.
Hi, welcome to the Audio Engineering... I can't. This is the Audio Engineering Podcast with me, Streaky, and...
And me, Shay.
And this is number 22?
22, yeah.
22, and we're going to be talking about EQ, equalization, if you like.
How, when, and why?
What?
Okay,
so I'll Shay, you can get going. Why not?
Sweet.
So I would say how, because I'm thinking if we're going from a recording through to a mastering rather than mastering back down,
yep,
let's go that way. So I would suggest, if you're recording, are you EQing when you record?
Yes. I mean, you do kind of anyway. If you've got a mic preamp or just an audio interface nowadays, or even on a microphone, they always have a low cut, like a high pass filter.
Now, would you always low cut?
Always. Right. I mean, okay, depends on what I'm recording. If I'm recording a kick drum, I probably wouldn't low cut it because I'd probably do that afterwards. But like for vocal, always. It's on the microphone, it's on the interface. So you're EQing before you've even done anything. Which was one thing at the ACM when I was doing like the recording, like the studio recording lectures, people saying like you don't have to EQ, and like the first port of EQ would be the desk and you don't have to do it. And it was saying things like, well, no, the first port of call is before it even gets there. If your microphone's got a sort of, what is it, normally 80 hertz cut or a 75 hertz cut, like some microphones like the 414 by AKG goes up to about 140 hertz, I think, you can cut from. And that's EQing, like straight away you're EQing something, you're getting rid of unwanted
frequency. What's that snare drum mic?
No, that's an all-rounder. That's like a AKG C414. It's everything. It's one of the best all-round mics, to be honest. Like full polar pattern pickage. Like you can have cardioid, hypercardioid, omnidirectional, figure of eight, and just loads of different low-cut filters you can have. I think it's down to about 40, 70, don't quote me on it, something like that, and like 140 again. But a really good all-round microphone, but you are EQing before you've even started. But then afterwards, on a preamp, like I use the UAD, like Unison preamps, and on the preamps there, I do a bit more EQing. I lift the top end a little bit, depending on the microphone that I'm using. Like if I'm using a dynamic mic, I'll always lift the top end a little bit on the EQ, whether it's on a desk or on like a desk emulation style plugin. But yeah, anything that I'm recording, really, I will be EQing it, because I'm trying to get the sound I want printed, rather than getting the sound and then dealing with that sound once it's done. If I can commit to a sound and print a sound that's pretty good, the mix stage is half done for me, because you're kind of mixing before you've recorded.
So it's mainly on a sort of standard plugin on a... What sort of plugins would you use for that?
I mean, I use two. I use the Unison UAD 610B Unison preamp plugin. And on that, it's got like a high band and a low band, basically, and I dip the lows by about 1.5 dB, give the highs a little bit, about 7k, between 7 and 10k, about 1.5 dB, something like that, just to brighten up the sound a little bit if I'm using a dynamic mic. Probably not so much on the condenser mic, but then after that it goes into a Neve 88 RS channel strip plugin, which is just an emulation of the 88 RS Neve desk. And yeah, again, there, it's just a tiny little bit of top end if I want it, but it's there if I want it. A lot of the time I don't necessarily need it, especially if it's like a nice condenser mic, but it's always there. There's always the option for it. It's not something that I'd overlook when I'm recording. And most of the time it is vocal recording that I'm doing. So it's high lifts, low cuts, sort of low mid cuts, low mid precision sort of takeouts at around about 200, 300 hertz, something like that.
And this is going back to the theory of EQ it, first of all, get the sound you want in the first place, so you don't have to then do that when you're mixing or mastering.
Yeah. Like I've
got all those bases covered as you're going up through the chain.
Yeah. Like even if I'm doing additive EQ at this stage, it's still surgical style EQ. Like it's an EQ to get the sound that I want rather than to exaggerate something. I'm not exaggerating anything. I'm just cutting out frequencies and lifting frequencies that, I mean, by tiny amounts. Like I'm not doing 10 dB at 12k. Like I'm not doing that. I'm doing like maybe a dB in the high end around about 7 to 10k, taking out a couple of dB on a really tight notch between sort of 200, 300, just to get rid of that sort of boxiness, depending on the mic, the placement, the singer.
Yeah, where it is, the room, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, but yeah, EQ-wise, from recording first, like, obviously you're going to be recording something when you're EQing, was what we're talking about first. It's, yeah. I'm doing it so I don't have to do that later on at the mix stage. And anything that I do at mix stage is going to be fine-tuning what I've already done rather than fixing something. Like we always talk about, like, I hate having to fix something that wasn't done properly in the first place. Like, yep. It's all well and good doing a couple of little bits here and there once it's been recorded well, but if it's not recorded well, all you're doing is trying to salvage something and you're only going to make it sound worse. You're not going to make it sound better because it wasn't any good in the first place.
And then moving on to mixing, how would you, what kind of EQs are you using at mix stage? I guess it's total slate for you. But
Not really. I mean, yes, a bit, but FabFilter, Pro-Q2, love that. I'm a big believer in stock plugins. If I'm doing a Pro Tools mix, I love the channel strip that comes in Pro Tools, just because it's surgical. I don't use it for a sound. I use it because it's like modeled off the Euphonics desk, digital EQ. And it's just a really clinical EQ. It's not so tony, like it hasn't got like extra tone like a Pultec has or something like that. It's just clinical. Same as the Logic EQ, just really simple. If I know exactly, like, I'd like to think at this sort of stage now, I can hear something and go 300 hertz or, do you know what I mean? Like, you know the area that you're in.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to be pulling something out that way. When I'm more into the additive style of, like, EQing and I want to get some tone out of it, I'm looking at the slate sort of stuff where I'm looking at, like, the VMR, where you've got the SSL and the Neve emulations, and that's really for colour.
Are you adding loads of EQ?
Not at all, really.
You know, the amount of dBs are, what, 3, 4?
Oh, no, I don't even go that high, to be honest. I mean, 4 is quite high, I think. I mean, yeah, even at that stage, like, I prefer to get a nice balance, like, with levels and panning before, like, I do like a panning and levels before I do any type of EQ whatsoever, and then just EQ to where it is leveled and where it's panned. But, I mean, it's maybe 4 dBs sometimes, but then that's just if it isn't right in the first place. Like, if it's okay in the first place, I'm doing maybe 2, max 3 dB here and there. But then it could be I do 2 dB on one EQ, then I'll compress it or stick some form of distortion or saturation style plugin, and then I'll EQ again afterwards to exaggerate or get rid of unwanted stuff after that next stage. If that,
yeah,
you know, so if it's causing,
yeah, if it's cause and effect, say for instance, compressed it, and then you want to open it up a little bit more after the compression, but you still want that compression feel.
Yeah.
You might add a bit more high end in there just to open it up.
Yeah, or like you've EQ'd something, then you put some compression on it, and then it sounds a little bit too thick or a little bit too, what's the word? Like thick, like just little bit too middly. Then EQ again, just take a little bit of mid out, lift the highs if you want to, tuck the low in again. But it's... I'm really always doing the same three things. It's a low cut, it's a high shelf, and it's a surgical anywhere in between takeout, pretty much. I don't know whether that's a good or a bad thing, but it's just the way that I instantly do it. It's like an autopilot thing that I do. Just, I know that it works. And again, it's probably coming from watching you do mastering at that stage, at like the last stage, where it's, there's a low cut involved. Do you know what I mean? There's always that involved. So like, I autopilot go to things like that. And then I'm looking at more subtractive EQ before I think of adding anything. Like, instead of, if it's dry in the high end and it's not sparkly enough, I won't straight away go and lift the high end. I'll find what's middly, low middly, and try and take some of that out to clear it up to see if the high end then sings. If it doesn't, then I can add some after, but I know I've got rid of what was masking it in the first place.
Yeah, so, I mean, since I worked with you a few years ago, I've totally changed my style.
Okay.
That's good. Yeah, no, it is good because as you sort of get older and you grow as an engineer and you watch different people, and I've obviously was working at Metropolis for, you know, 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so by being there with those guys, looking at what they're doing, listening to equipment in different ways, working out, basically just, copying other people like everyone does. I tend to work in a slightly different way than I used to, mm-hmm. although I still obviously have those EQ settings and things all in the bank, mm-hmm. and and I do pull them out more, but I tend to find that for me EQing, I EQ a lot less these days, and I think that's more down to the fact that I can hear more of what I'm doing. I can hear, if you can hear what you're doing, and this goes back to what we're always saying about setting up your room correctly, making sure that you can hear the speakers and having good speakers, pay the money for the speakers rather than the equipment, pay money for, you know,
the environment.
The environment, yeah, that's right. So that we, you know, it's getting that right. Once you've got that right, you don't need as much equipment as you think you need.
Yeah.
And that's certainly true with the amount of EQ you do. That's why I was interested to ask you how much you're putting on to things.
Yeah.
Because when you get to mastering, by that stage, there's so much been added anyway. The amount of headroom you've got, you're only adding half a dB, one dB.
Yeah, completely.
Maximum 2 dB, but then you're adding quite a lot with 2 dB.
Yeah.
So it's usually just little half here or little tweak there. With EQ, I tend to add more than I cut.
Okay. Yeah, but it's a different stage though, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, that's always been the way for me. I just prefer to enhance rather than dehance.
Yeah.
Don't think that's a word, is it?
Yeah.
But you know, I prefer to add than take away, because I think when you start taking away, especially at mastering stage, because you haven't got the individual tracks to play with, you can't add some. You know, once you've taken away, it's taking away from everything in that frequency
exactly,
range,
yeah.
Rather than just the one thing you're cutting into. If you're just doing if you've got vocal separated, of course you can cut into that and do whatever you like. But when you're dealing with the stereo file only, it's a totally different practice.
Yeah.
So I tend to kind of add more, as I say, but I tend to add less these days just because I've just noticed that maybe I've refined my settings more as the years have gone on. And so I don't tend to slap on as much as I would have done previously. On less, but in the right areas
so that
it's highlighting. And it was always something that I found quite exciting when I used to watch. Exciting isn't probably the word, but interesting. When I used to watch like high end mastering engineers and think, how can they do that? How can they just add one setting and it makes it sound right?
Yeah.
And I've got to that point where I think I can do that now. And it's quite fun to be able to challenge yourself to do less EQing and to just add one setting, plus going through, you know, adding one setting isn't the thing really. The EQ and the sound of the sound of the equipment you build up and the cables you put in and the sound of the equipment that you like over the years. And as we've talked about, we've compressors not compressing and just sort of running through stuff just all means that sound that you've built up from all those years of listening to certain bits of equipment means you don't have to add much EQ.
Yeah. And you know,
and I think that's the key. That's the key. It's not the fact that before you don't know the gear, do you? So when you don't know the gear as well, you haven't been working on it for 10 years or 15 years or whatever, you kind of know, okay, well, that one always sounds good after that one, even though I'm not doing anything on it. And then all I have to do is add a little bit of top at the end and it sounds great.
Yeah, exactly. It's the combinations. Like, you could have all the same gear, but if they're run in a different combination, it's like plugins in a chain in Logic. Like, I don't know if I've said it before, but a lot of the students at ACM would put loads of the right plugins on, but in a completely random order. So you do realize that it makes a difference. Like, whatever you put first happens first. Like, the audio runs through them like a chain, like it's a plug-in chain. So if you could have the same gear that you're using every day, and if you put it in completely a random order and still did the same settings, it's not going to sound drastically different, but it will sound different because you're bleeding.
It's kind of because it is EQing it in a way, isn't it? It's kind of affecting the sound the way all the parts of it are made up one after another. And
well, say if you've got all your valve gear at the end of the chain rather than at the start of the chain, you're going to get a very different sound. Say you've got a valve EQ at the start going into another valve EQ which goes into a VCA compressor with exactly the same settings. If you put the VCA compressor before both of those valve EQs, it's going to be drastically different.
Yeah,
completely different. So like, it's knowing the gear that you've got, knowing how those pieces of gear work, but not just how they work together, like as a combination of things. Like, this works really good at 3 dB or say 2 dB at 2K, but only after this certain piece of equipment that you've got.
And because it's after that, I don't need to EQ anything.
Yeah.
Because I know that bit of equipment is always bright.
Yeah.
So because it's bright, I just put that compressor on. It's a bright compressor. It's not only going through it, but it's bright.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't have to put any top on. Or the limiter is really bright at the end.
Yeah.
So like the fab filter, really, well, no, not the fab really, but the L2, for example,
yeah,
super bright limiter. So you know it's, oh God, you can't put much top on before it because otherwise it's going to rip your head off.
Like how many times when you were using the Neumann limiter and beforehand it was just a bit of EQ, high-end EQ, and it wasn't right. And then you took the EQ out and just put the Neumann limiter in, and it was a limiter. It wasn't an EQ. It was a limiter.
Yeah,
but it
yeah.
gave you that presence that you wanted from the EQ. But you would only know that by using it and having it in the place and the chain that it was at the time.
Yeah, and knowing in your and having it in your, because you've used it so much.
Yeah.
This goes back to have the other thing we talk about all the time is just having a small amount of equipment and a small amount of plugins that you go to all the time, just so that you've got them in your head and you know, okay, that's what that sound does because I know it. That's my sound. That's my signature sound now in my head. And so that's why that goes in the chain at that point, because I know it's going to sound a certain way after that bit of equipment, before this.
Yeah.
It's just learning that chain. And by having that chain, it kind of does a lot of the EQing for you, which was something that took me years to work out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, going back to production-wise, like we talk about recording, we didn't really say much about the production side of things. Like if I'm producing a track, say with synthesizers, like hardware synthesizers, and recording things in with synths and that, I'm EQing it. I'm re-queuing the sound that I have because I know what I want it to be sounding like in the mix. So I wouldn't have to be doing that much at mix stage. I just have to be doing the balance and I just have to be doing the panning, if anything. It's like doing as little as possible. I think the biggest problem I had when I first started making music was getting an EQ that had 7 bands on it and using every 7 band. And then opening another one after it and being like, oh, this is a 10 band EQ, like shit.
Yeah, 10 bands. Got 10 to play with.
Exactly, rather than looking at it and just thinking, okay, 2K sounds a bit harsh, pull it out on a tight one. I've still got 9 bands left, but I don't need to use them.
Yeah.
So, it's just refining what you've got and sort of knowing your frequencies. I think understanding frequencies, one of the most boring things to do is just to listen to frequency, like listen to, like, you know, like a tone generator, to hear how that frequency makes you feel. And it's one of the things I used to do in lectures where I'd play a 19K tone and see who can hear it. Just randomly in the middle of something, I just
heard a 9K tone.
But like putting tones on and just saying, "What's that?" and seeing if it's annoying, but afterwards some students were like 400, and I'd be like, "Oh, not bad, 450." And then it gets you into you know what that tone not just sounds like on its own, but what it feels like to you. So when you listen to something, you can go straight away 250 too much, or needs a little bit more snare body 200. You know what your tones are, and then from that point you can understand what EQ to use after that. What style of EQ is it? An empty 200 or is it a full 200? Maybe I'll go for a valve sound EQ, or maybe I'll go for a passive style EQ if I want it a little bit cleaner. Those kind of things. Like so much stuff comes into play with EQing, but then it matters. You need to know what to do so you don't do the wrong things.
Yep, and you need to know the EQ that you're then going to pull up to do it. Because for instance, I haven't got one. I've used them many times in the past, but I haven't got one. And I'm talking about a Manly Massive Passive.
Oh yeah.
And the only reason I haven't got one is because firstly, I don't like Manly equipment, but that's just because I find it a little bit too over tubey.
Okay. Yeah.
But I did use the Massive Passive for a little bit. And the only frequency I found that I liked was a sort of 800 mark around there, 850 or something. I think.
Oh really? That's a weird.
Yeah. So that was the only thing I found that I could use it for. And I don't use that EQ setting that often, really. Mm-hmm. So it kind of makes the whole thing redundant. So like by just pulling that up, I know, okay, well, I don't like the high end on that EQ. I like the high end of an Avalon.
Yeah. See, when I used the Massive Passive, it was at a studio when it was more like mixing sort of stuff and like processing of things. We use it for recording as well. And even then, I didn't really like it. Like I don't. I like the sound of the slam. I like the compressors, but I don't like the EQ. I didn't like the sound of the EQ at all. Compared to something like a Masalec, it was another contest.
No, it's a totally different world. I mean, the thing is, when it comes to EQs, they sometimes do work well with each other. Like the Manly is good with the Masalec, so that you could do things with EQ into one and stuff, but. You know, that's all too much work, really. You don't need to be doing that much work with things. So that's why I don't find the Manly that usable. I mean, people love it. I'm not saying that it's bad. Some people absolutely love it. But then that means that that's just part of the sound in their head that they like. And so then that means people will go to them as a mastering engineer because they like that sound.
Yeah, I mean, when I use the mount, because it's Tube Gear, I was thinking it's going to be super warm, it's gonna be proper tasty, and I don't know, I just thought it was not as warm as I was expecting it to be, compared to something that's not a valve compressor, like a valve EQ, that you can get some proper nice warmth out of. Do you know what I mean? Like, I didn't really fancy it that much, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, the Massilex mainstay EQ of mine, which I'm so used to, you kind of know the certain frequency bands that work well. They don't, you know, every EQ has a certain frequencies that you like. It's not the fact that an EQ, you could have one EQ and it does everything you possibly could want. But there's certain EQs that have a lot of frequencies, and that's why they're more, they're worth having over, it's like one Manly, you know.
Of course,
The Massilex probably got, I don't know, 20 usable frequencies that I use a lot.
Yeah. It's like a Pultec EQ. Like, there's only a few frequencies you can pick from, but they're apparently like musical areas. Like, what does that mean? Does that annoy you when you hear it's tuned musically? It's got like musical points. Like, how do you? What's musical?
It's a musical EQ.
Yeah, like, do me a favor.
But, see, I kind of get it.
Do you? Because, I don't.
Well, I do, because I only from using the Sontek, and the Sontek is, okay, so how I would describe musical, if someone says, oh, it's a musical EQ, I would just say it's kind of lush, and it kind of works with the sound.
Yeah, but I mean,
does that make sense?
It does, but when someone says it's the musical frequency ranges, like, well, is it in key? How do you know what key my song's in? How do you know?
No.
I think
that surely when someone's saying musical, it just means I can dial up most frequencies and it sounds and it works.
Yeah.
Right. So even if I turn up the top end, it's smooth.
Yeah.
If I do the bottom end, it's punchy.
Yeah.
It's just like an EQ that works
in the main areas. Yeah. In the main areas of music. So you would get like a musical 20k hertz lift. For instance, you'd get more like a 12 or like a 8 or something like that. Yeah, but I mean, even then, I think it's just marketing, though, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Musically chosen frequency ranges. No, it's not.
Yeah, it's a load of toss.
And it's the capacitors that were used. It's nothing to do with that.
Yeah. I mean, the vibe of an EQ is important. I mean, but, you know, the Sontek, there you go. For an example, I would just run through that because it's just the ID something or other.
What?
I don't know.
Capacitance.
There's some kind of circuits in it that just sound fantastic just going through. But then I prefer the sound of the Massilex EQ rather than the Sontek.
Okay.
Which is a massive statement because obviously one's three times the price of the other. Yeah. But I don't think that's important. It's just the fact that there's more available of the Massilex. So then you'll get more out of it. And then people say the Buzz Audio, they like that.
Yeah, it's Buzz, okay. SPL.
Yeah, I've not heard the SPL. They keep blanking me. I wanted to get it on a demo.
What about
if anyone's listening who knows SPL, Avalon, amazing. All their equipment is
good, isn't it?
Top draw.
It's like treacle, isn't it?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But also, it's not that massive in price. The bigger EQs are, they're mental money. But... you know, like a preamp, the preamp they do or whatever is 1200, about 1200 quid or something.
Well, how much is the 7? Is it the 737? The one that you use?
That's the one EQ? I'm talking about. Yeah, I've got the 747.
Okay, yeah, the one that's
747 is the compressor with
stereo compressor and EQ.
An EQ,
EQ's lovely. I mean, it's a graphic, but it's a lovely EQ, isn't it? Yeah,
unbelievable top end on that EQ. It's
the bottom end.
It's exactly the same sound as the 12 grand Avalon.
Yeah,
32k.
Yeah.
So it's like just that air band that you want to put on stuff. It's great. I have it at the end of my chain so that I can run through it, add a little bit of warmth from the valves on the compression side, and then add a little bit of top to the end. It's just
the low end on that was always really nice. Like literally just nudging it off center a little bit. I don't know. And there's no sort of real DB count on it.
It's the classic smiley face. Graphic equalizer.
Yeah,
it just works. It's a joy. It's so easy to use. Just is it good or is it not? And that's what I love about it.
And being able to put it pre or post the compression as well with a really nice compression sound. Anyway, it's just that's a lovely piece of gear. I'd like one of those. To be fair, I would like.
They're
one
brilliant.
Of those, just as a mix bus processor.
The 737, which is the mic pre one.
Yeah,
that's supposed to be. I don't use that, but everyone I know who does use it loves it.
Hmm.
Absolutely loves it. Says it's like, again, like we're saying about the, you know, having the 747. They've got loads of stuff that's really good. I just think they're underrated.
And, yeah.
You know, I don't think as many people know about them. But
I remember the first time I heard it at yours, the when it was in and out. It sounded really nice. And then you took it out and it was like a sabotage button. Like, what's happened? Yeah. What have you done? Like, what's happened? And you put it back in, like, oh, okay, there it is. It's just massive, like forward, open, still really clean. It's like, oh, it does so much. Yeah.
It's just great.
Doing the littlest increments on it gives you so much to the sound. Like, when you do press it, when you do bypass it, you're like, what have I done? Like,
That's right. I don't think there's a time where you put it in and it sounds bad. Mm. It's just sometimes you put it in and it might sound too much,
mm-hmm.
but it's never bad.
I mean, it's a good too much. Yeah, it's good at the start and the end. Because I remember when it was one of the first things in the chain, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was one of the first things. And now you say you use it as the last thing.
Yeah, so it's because I've got something tubular. I've got the, in my chain, I have the warm interface at the front.
Okay, yeah.
Which is just basically a tube line amp by Summit.
Yeah.
And so I've got that. So as you come into the analog chain, then I'm hitting something nice and warm, mm-hmm. and then moving on to like just normal stuff. And then at the end, I've got something warm if I want it as well.
Do you still have that Neumann, the limo?
Yeah. I love the Neumann. I didn't use it for years, that Neumann compressor. I stopped using it. And then I started to, when I was doing attended sessions, popping it in and people going, oh, what was that?
Yeah.
And so then I was like, all right, maybe I like it again. And then now I never used to change the settings on it, because
mm-hmm.
I just used to have it as one setting and it was either in or out. Do I like it? Do I not?
Mm.
But now I've found that obviously I've started to mess around with the releases and the attack times, and it's really usable mm-hmm. just having it. So I've got a really slow attack and fast release.
Yeah,
obviously, then it's hardly touching the compressor, but it's just going through it. It sounds brilliant. But
that had a really nice top end to it. Like I said before, like it had that.
The best EQ with the top end ever is the Neumann. Is the one that's the same as that? It's the Neumann EQ that is the same out of the same cutting lathe.
Okay.
As those compressors.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable top end and low end, like 60 hertz. But the high end is just, it comes up from about 3k all the way up to about 15,
yeah.
and it's just superb shelf. I mean,
lovely.
You can put that on. I mean, going back to doing shelving, I've got a Bax that I use. I don't know if you use one in recording, but I use a Bax quite a lot for just sort. I have that quite early on in the chain, just mm-hmm. to okay, right? How's the balance of the track, you know, sounding? I mean, I've done videos on all of these anyway, but there's. If I want more low end, or if I want to just shave off a bit of top coming into the desk and stuff, it's a brilliant EQ.
See, I use
it
the Bax.
Sounds great.
I use the Bax at the end of the chain, pretty much, just before
final. Perfect.
Yeah,
exactly what I'm doing in effect.
Because you're doing it first. Yeah.
Because I'm doing it first, so I'm kind of going, okay, how does this sound? So it's a brilliant mix bus.
Yeah, it's a lovely sheen EQ, really nice sheen EQ. And it's not overly brittle, like you can really pump the high end in it. Another one, the Marg EQ, M-A-A-G, with a 40 hertz shelf at the top.
Right.
Like an insanely studio, you can't hear it, but it's just so good. Yeah, what did I say, 40 hertz? 40k, yeah. Yeah, the 40k, that's just lovely.
Yeah, like an
really
band.
Good. Yeah, proper airy band. Really nice. But I do like the Bax. I like the sound of the Bax. I like the low end of the Bax. I really like the low end on that. But I'm not using the hardware version. I'm using the UAD version.
So yeah, they're not far off each other. It loses a little bit of depth.
Yeah, but then before, I mean, because I say it's the last thing in my chain, I'm not really looking for that added analog color from it. I've got the saturation stuff I've got before. So where I'm using it, it's spot on. Like, and again, it's not really that much. I'm using maybe 1-2 dB max on the mix, like 1.5 dB in the high and the low, not that much at all. And it just makes so much more difference, like brings the track a little bit more forward, gives it a little bit more of an anchor in the low range. Like, it's really nice.
Yeah, if you can, there's a setting as well, 18K, if you take 1 dB off at 18K.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really nice because it just settles the track down a bit rather than, you know, sometimes things can sound a little bit digital and a bit too harsh by the time you've got everything rolling.
It makes it sound a little bit more tapey, a little bit more warmer without adding warmth. You're just taking away a little bit of the harshness.
Yeah, just a little trim off, which is nice. Takes the edge off the top.
Yeah, yeah.
MS EQing, we haven't discussed that. I mean, I used to do a lot of MS EQing. I don't do hardly any at all now.
Really?
If anything.
Okay. Is your Masalec not MS anymore?
No.
Really?
No. So okay. I tend not to, because I find, as I was saying earlier, that I'm not EQing as much. Mm-hmm. I'm not needing to. I find that I was doing too much MS EQing. Okay. I mean, when I say too much, I was doing half a dB at 1.7K or something. It's hardly, you know. Yeah. The only thing I like it for is for sorting out the low end.
Yeah, monoing the bass up a bit, really.
But, you know, I don't even mono much anymore either in the low end.
See,
because I think a lot of people now are knowing, a lot of the mix engineers I'm working with know that they've already kind of done that.
Yeah, exactly. Got it mono.
It's only if the mix is wrong
that I need to
use like heavy MS. But I'd rather just go back to the engineer and say, look, just can you mono the bass, or can you take some of that weird phase stuff like plugin you've got on, because it's ruining the whole mix.
Yeah, I was about to say
Better to do that than go, okay, well, let's just mono everything, because you do lose a massive amount of like heavy low end. Mm-hmm. There's like a lot going on sometimes in the there's nothing going on in the stereo, but by thinning it out, you just lose a little bit of sound, and then you end up having to add more EQ to make up for it. Mm-hmm. Well, you're better off not doing anything at all and just kind of asking somebody just to mono it themselves.
Yeah. I mean, before like mid-side was sort of a mastering thing, mid-side, whereas now you're seeing a lot more of it happening, even at production stage and definitely at mix stage. So there's probably not that much, like, it's overkill when you're doing it at mastering stage as well, because there's a good 60% chance it's already been done. Yeah,
it's going to ruin the mix, because a lot of people will use it. It's you know, it's a subtle trick, and the thing is, a lot of people use it because they think that's the secret. Everyone's looking for the secret. Well, there's no secret. The secret is don't do anything.
Yeah.
But the secret is you can pop the vocal out a bit if you want to, very slightly at 1.7K or something in mid-side. You can add a little bit of fancy work in the top end with the sides and stuff. But the problem you're going to do, you're always messing with somebody's mix, and you're always going to change the sound of it in quite a dramatic way with MS EQ in it. And I don't think it's a good idea. I think you're not there to totally recreate the mix. Yeah. I think you're there to enhance and to sort of bring out the beauty of the sound, rather than just go in and rip it apart. And I think a lot of mastering engineers, or, you know, not very experienced mastering engineers, think that they're in this massive creative process where it's their opportunity to go, oh, this is my sound, and it's nothing about that. You're enhancing. You're not there to give it the streaky sound. It's just you're getting the best of what's there, speaking to the mix engineer, hopefully getting them to do any tweaks that you can, and keep working like that until you've got it sounding, you know, great, exactly how you want it.
The problem I found with mid-side EQ is that I would always carry on doing something until I heard a massive drastic difference in what was going on, because I needed it to be, it was a mid-side EQ, so it needed to be mid-sidey. I needed to hear a big difference in the stereo image, whereas knowing now, like, you don't really have to hear it doing mid-side. I'm only using mid-side
because you're mixing, you're being too expressive with it, and so you're kind of doing what should be happening in the mix. And that's the problem, because you're wanting that creativity from it, where it's not that. It's for kind of getting the mix out of a hole if it's something that you know that's not going to happen. The mix engineer is not going to get it, so you can kind of nudge a little bit out here and there, or maybe open it up a bit with you know, not nudging the vocal up a touch. If they're like, oh, well, I haven't got the mix anymore, I can't do anything with it, you know, it was a mix from 2 years ago, I can't get it back. And it's like, okay, fine, I can get you out of jail a bit, you know. So that's how I would use it these days, where before I would be using it a lot heavier for, you know, bringing out bass and things like that, where I tend to like just bringing out bass across the stereo field now rather than going that deep on stuff.
Yeah. I mean,
I just don't think going that deep on stuff is the way to go with mastering. No. It's like, it's just too much.
I mean, mid-side wise, it's the first thing I do on a mix bus is mid-side processing. And it is sort of to open up the track, but it's a lot less than I was doing before. Like, all I'm doing now is maybe low cut in the mids, so a low cut, so I'm making sure that I'm the bass is nice and tight, and then more of a low cut in the sides, pretty much, and then that's it. But then beforehand I was doing like 90 hertz, 100 hertz in the sides, where now I'm nowhere near that. I'm more sort of like 50-60 sort of top.
That's a good point, because when I was when I wanted to mono the bass, I was working my way down the frequency so much. Mm-hmm. As you say, I'd start at, when we used to cut vinyl years ago on Neumann console, it was 150 was where the elliptical filter, which is the monoing thing, that's the standard setting. It was like 150 and then 70, I think.
Really?
So I used to start years ago monoing at 150. Mm-hmm. I mean, it touches the vocal and everything, so it's kind of ruining loads of stuff going on there.
And if you're thinking about sort of rock music, where you could have a lot of low, that's not necessarily bass, but like guitar tone,
in
that sort of low region, and you're cutting it and you're cutting it out in the sides, man. Like, I found it from a rock album that I did for someone, like a band, and I was doing 80 hertz in the sides, cutting it out, and it was making it sound really wide, and like, that's what I was using it for the width. But then like the guitarist.
Well, you mean
like,
the top end was sounding really wide and the bottom sounding. Yeah, well, rock music is a definite thing where, like, guitar music, anything acoustic, there's so much going on under 100 hertz, which has nothing to do with the bass.
Yeah.
There's like harmonics and all sorts of stuff going on. As soon as you start monoing that, it just sounds dreadful.
Well, the guitarist was saying, like, it sounds all right, but like the sides, my guitar sounds really thin in the sides. Like, it's I use like a phaser, like he was using like a phaser pedal, which makes everything go super wide and stuff anyway. But I was still panning each of the guitars, so it was two separate takes. But all I was doing was getting rid of all of the tone that was in the sides, so it just sounded like a thinness whirling around, like a Wurlitzer type thinness. And then I just got rid of that from 80 hertz and brought it down to 50, so I still had no sub in there, but I had a lot more frequency in there, and it was like, there it is, that's much better. And then I from then I was like, geez, all this time I've been cutting so high.
I did it for ages, and then I had a couple of clients go, can you not mono under thing? And I was thinking, why? It sounds brilliant. Brilliant.
But what do you know?
obviously I wasn't listening. And I was just plowing in, you know, which is something we always saying. Listen first and take your time. And I think that's what you get with experience and age, is you just take longer over listening to how it should sound and what it's doing, rather than, you know, by the times you've got to the first verse, you've already banged on a load of EQ settings. It's like, Christ alive. But, you know, I'm guilty of it. I used to do it all the time.
Yeah, the problem with it, it's the same as everything. The only way you're going to learn is from mistakes, errors. And mistakes, and someone point it out to you, like, you think you could have the best sound going. If it's duff, it's duff. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't know because you've been spending so long on it. It takes someone else to come in and go, what are you doing? Like, what's this? And then you change it. You think to yourself at the time, well, no, it can't be. I know I'm right. You change it and you realize, actually, the past 3 years, I've probably been shaving off a little bit too much from the sides.
And you wish you could go back and redo all those tracks.
Yeah, yeah. You think about getting your contact list out and, like, doing apology letters. Oh, no.
Failure is the sweat of success, the saying is, which is exactly true for that, isn't it?
You have to regress to progress.
Look out.
That was me. That's Shay
coming up now.
Quoted Shay 2017.
T-shirt in the making.
There we go. Yeah, man.
Right, okay. Well, we must have covered everything on EQ now, haven't we?
Close enough. We could talk about it for days. There's probably about seven more podcasts worth of EQ to talk about.
Basically, that's all you do as a mastering engineer is EQ. Mm. So, you know, it's like a pianist talking about pianos.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, thanks for listening. Thanks for if you've stayed this long on the podcast. Thanks.
Yeah, cheers. That was a long one, wasn't it?
This long. And please subscribe so that you don't miss some more. Go to the website YouTube. You may have heard of it, where you can see more from Shay's channel and my channel. And there's links there to loads of other things you can see: Instagram, Facebook, blah blah. And make sure you subscribe and tell all your friends and. Yeah, thank you. That'll do.
Cheers.
Cheers. Bye.